6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places.
Thank you for listening to A Public Affair. It is Wednesday, March 2nd, 2016. And I'm your host, Karma Chavez. Over the past several years, and probably not surprisingly, in conjunction with what we often refer to as now the Great Recession, the struggle over the value and worth of Black lives has gained unprecedented national attention. Of course, the economic destruction since 2008 has been most acutely felt by Black communities, along with Indigenous peoples, Latinos, and Southeast Asians. But the connections between race and debt and also property, rendered completely transparent by the Great Recession, have long-standing connections throughout Western history. Classically, in The Merchant of Venice, for example, it's the racial other, the Jew who demanded repayment of debt in flesh when property was unavailable. Treating flesh as property was the principle animating the slave trade, a business sustained by debt secured by Black human quote-unquote property. Post-emancipation, Black sharecroppers remained tied down by debt and by lack of property ownership. The hyper-incarceration of poor Blacks today justifies itself by extracting a debt owed to society. Calls for reparations claim that society owes a debt to Blacks or to other communities that have suffered injustices. That's just a little piece of the description of a symposium that's going to be held next Friday and Saturday, co-sponsored by Comparative U.S. Studies and the UW Institute for Research in the Humanities. It is a symposium called Race, Debt, and Property, designed to discuss these connections with some of the most prominent thinkers in the country, including folks like Jody Melamed, Cedric Johnson, and Joanne Barker. The lead organizer of this event is Vincent Lloyd. Vincent Lloyd is an assistant professor of religion at Syracuse University and currently a Kingdon Fellow at the Institute for Research in the Humanities here at UW-Madison. Dr. Lloyd is also a leading thinker on such issues and a prolific scholar focusing on religious traditions and Black political thought. Despite finishing a PhD in rhetoric from the University of California, Berkeley in just 2008, he's already the author of three books, Law and Transcendence on the Unfinished Project of Gillian Rose from Palgrave Macmillan in 2009. Also, The Problem with Grace, Reconfiguring Political Theology. That's from Stanford University Press in 2011. And he has a book forthcoming from Oxford University Press this May called Black Natural Law. He's also edited several books, including Race and Secularism in America, and another called Sainthood and Race, and those are just two. I don't know what you do other than work, but in addition to this impressive amount of work, Dr. Lloyd is also currently working on a project on religion in mass incarceration, which I'm very excited about, and I'm really excited to hear a bit more about his work and to learn about this symposium next weekend. So, Dr. Vincent Lloyd, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thank you so much for having me.
For sure. So, Vincent Lloyd, you have deep and diverse political and intellectual interests. So I'm wondering if you could characterize a bit for us, though, what you see as kind of your current intellectual political project.
Thanks, Karma. Yeah, the question I've been thinking about recently and through much of my academic career over the last few years is how religious communities can be mobilized to advance social justice. A lot of the times when we think about religious communities, either people on the left have a sort of negative reaction, right? This is what we moved away from in after our childhood or our youth, or religious communities are moralizing and, we want to be escape from them. Or that, religious communities might be sort of networks or spaces that can foster sort of liberal politics. What I've been trying to think about is how can religious ideas and practices not just sort of support the status quo, not just moralize, not just sort of push a liberal political agenda, but how can religious communities foster grassroots community organizing? How can they challenge the wisdom of the world, ideology? How could they, in more practical terms, challenge pressing problems of today, like mass incarceration, right? The people, the imprisonment of many minorities and others in the U.S. Globally.
Well, and so this is interesting to me. So when you say religious traditions, are there particular ones that you focus on?
Right. So that's a good question. My own training has been in thinking about Christianity. And I think I'm a bit wary of interfaith dialogue as a political activity, right? It seems like within many faith traditions, right, there are resources to think critically about the world, right, about dominant ideas and just taken for granted assumptions, to think, you know, what everyone is saying or what it seems like everyone is saying might be deeply wrong, right? What we see on the television every day might be missing some dramatically different ways of seeing the world or thinking about the world. And many different religious traditions have ways of imagining differently, imagining beyond what we see, imagining beyond what's obvious to us when we look around. So while my own background has been in thinking about Christianity, I enjoy working with scholars from other traditions who can tap into the resources of the tradition that they know about in order to, you know, help us think differently, imagine differently about our world, and also help us, you know, catalyze the kind of organizing work that is so essential in many different communities.
I know one of the things that I've often thought about, because I've actually been thinking about this question a lot lately, and I'll ask you to expand on this other piece of this question about contemporary movements, but I remember last summer I was in Jerusalem and was in Al-Aqsa Mosque and being shown around. And, you know, this is a stunning place, right? And then I started to think more broadly about spaces of organized religion and how beautiful they are. And it occurred to me that that's one of the big resources that organized religion brings, is these fantastic spaces. And I'm wondering if you could expand a bit on what you see are some of these primary resources that come from religious traditions that are useful for mobilizing.
Thanks. Yeah. So in one sense, right, there are sort of physical resources, right, buildings, structures. There are also social networks, right, that exist in religious communities. But also, you know, importantly, there are skills that develop, right? If one is, you know, in a church and on a committee, right, when the sort of gains some social capital and ability to work with others from different sorts of backgrounds, make a budget, these sorts of things, which, you know, in some kinds of organizing can be really useful. And of course, essentially building relationships, you know, among people who share common concerns, and using those relationships to achieve common interests can be really essential, right? When Martin Luther King, of course, is an ambivalent figure, but you know, I think he's too often remembered as either just a preacher or an activist. But when he went to Montgomery, Alabama, to take up his first ministerial position at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, the very first thing that he did was think about, you know, first, you know, how can this church stop being a church of rich people, right? Mm. And second, right, how can we build relationships amongst the members of this church, right? Mm. And between the members of this church and the community in which it's situated, right? Mm-hmm. So those practices of, you know, creating bonds between people in a religious space, bonds that might not be about religion, right? King created birthday month clubs, so everyone who had a January birthday would get together, right? And, you know, would share concerns, you know, about themselves. The groundwork was laid for challenging, right, segregation when the bus boycott began. It wasn't just about, having the physical space to meet, right, and having these, you know, financial assets, right, in a community where there weren't other places to have financial assets, right, was important, right, having a kind of public space, right, where there weren't other public spaces was important, but also having those relationships built and having the capacity to build more relationships, cross-cutting relationships, was really crucial.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you bring up another aspect of your work, sort of relation to thinking about King and civil rights movement, which is the the kind of racialized piece of this. So a lot of your work is focusing also on religious traditions in relation to African-American communities. And I'm wondering if you talk about a little bit about how you got interested in those particular convergences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I moved to Atlanta, Georgia in 2008 to take up my first academic job. And I'd never lived in the South before. I'd grown up in the Midwest and gone to school in the East Coast and West Coast. Of course, Atlanta and the South is very different in many ways than other parts of the country. And I was living just a few blocks from all of this Martin Luther King commemorative stuff, right? These statues and museums and libraries and so on, and you know, things that were street signs and other things that were dedicated to the memory of King. And I started thinking, there's sort of King that we're all familiar with, who likes to talk about love and peace and everyone getting along, but maybe there's a more interesting King as well, right? Who's critical of the wisdom of the road, right? Who's invested in community organizing and not just telling people that they ought to go march or something like that, right? Over the last few years, I've been thinking, reading the writings of King and others, and reading about them and thinking about what they were involved with and what anti-segregation protests and organizing involved. Some of the, what can we say about King besides, that he was into love, right? Well, right. He also talked about a law, right? And about hell, right? And about, things that, sin, right? Doing things that are wrong, right? And these are not, when King was talking about these, right, they were not in terms of personal morality, not in terms of, were late to class and so you're a sinner or something like that, or, these sort of personal sexual moralizing. Most of the time, King was, thinking about sin and hell and damnation, all these sorts of things in terms of, systematic injustices, mm-hmm. right, and inviting his listeners collectively, right, to work towards challenging these systematic injustices, whether they were segregation or whether they were colonialism, which King was also, of course, very concerned with, economic injustice, it's a broad range of issues, which, might seem disparate or it might seem as if, it was just the Vietnam War that made King have better politics, or it was just, being around sort of secular white people later in his life that made King have better politics. But, reading King's speeches and sermons from when he was just a student, he was concerned about colonialism, economic justice, segregation, all of these together, right, as, blemishes on the image of God, right, as violations of God's law, from when he was, very young. So, I think by thinking about and listening to King's specifically religious language and his specifically black, right, concerns, there are these sort of powerful resources that often go untapped when we're only concerned about the, the peace and lovey kind of King.
So this is an interesting point. I mean, I would love to spend a whole show just talking to you about King and sort of rethinking, especially early King, and his sources of invention for his political thought. But I actually want to move that a little bit to the contemporary time, because I think it's often been phrased a bit as a generational divide. But I'm wondering what role you're seeing right now, kind of King's thought or even the black church more broadly, playing in current political struggles for black liberation. And maybe then a follow-up to that is what role might they play?
Even in the anti-segregation movement, many black churches, probably the majority of black churches, were very resistant to taking an active role. And yet there were some that took this very active and prophetic role. So I think when we're and of course, the black church is very diverse, right, as a phrase that refers to many things, right? It refers to sort of mainline Protestant churches, to Pentecostal churches, to Catholic churches as well that are predominantly African-American. I think this kind of diversity is important to appreciate when we're thinking about, what we see happening now in terms of Black Lives Matter and more generally the, increasing awareness of racial injustice today. So, of course, we do see some churches that are, you know, very concerned and, you know, taking leading roles. We see some churches that are cautious. But I think even more than and I think much more broadly, we see churches that if they can have the right sorts of conversations and conversation partners are willing to open their spaces and their resources to those struggling for racial justice and to themselves join the struggle. So, I mean, I think there is a worry that I have about leftist politics today, that sometimes there can be such an allergy to religion, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, both on the white left and the black left, right, that there's a suspicion of having those sorts of engagements for with communities that, you know, are primed to think about justice, but might be might need some time to be in conversation about what justice looks like, and might, you know, need to be educated about what justice looks like. And, you know, leftist political activists and organizers also maybe could be educated about what thinking creatively and imaginatively about political possibilities looks like from religious communities that are used to thinking beyond the terms of the world, right? Thinking imaginatively about, you know, what is possible that we might not have imagined as yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is interesting, and you provide some really, I think, important historical perspective too that maybe helps us to understand a bit this tension and also the roles that churches, in particular, Black churches, have played. Do you see any notable shifts in the way that role has changed over the last century that you think might be especially instructive for thinking about today?
Yeah, so I think over the last 30 or 40 years, there have been dramatic changes, somewhat ironically, with integration, right? Just in terms of the social structure of the Black community, right? When Black elites are being educated in predominantly white institutions, right? This is creating, you know, I think a suspicion of this, among other things, is creating a sort of suspicion of Black religion that might not have been there before, and a sort of commitment to a sort of both a secularism and white liberal or progressive politics. That forgets about maybe more radical and more critical strands of Black political engagement and organizing that, you know, once were predominant, when there isn't one sort of monolithic, seemingly monolithic thing that you can point to, segregation or slavery, mm-hmm. Against which to organize. But there are just as invidious injustices that you know, need to be challenged, right? Finding the languages and resources to do that, you know, can be a struggle, particularly when there's fragmentation within the Black community because of, you know, ironically, because of these increased opportunities.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fascinating, thinking about a lack of a clear villain in a concrete sense. And yet, I mean, as we'll talk about in a little bit, I think the issue of mass incarceration is perhaps becoming that. And I definitely want to talk with you a bit about that. But this is A Public Affair, and I'm Karma Chavis, and we're talking with Dr. Vincent Lloyd, who is assistant professor of religion at Syracuse and also currently a fellow at the UW Institute for Humanities. He's hosting a symposium next Friday and Saturday at the Fluno Center on campus. So very fancy. You got the Fluno Center. This is called Race, Property, and Debt. And it begins on Friday morning at 9 a.m., run all day. And then on next Saturday in the morning as well, there'll be a community conversation. So, Dr. Lloyd, I wanted to get a chance to talk to you just a moment about your forthcoming book, and then I want to move into talking about mass incarceration and then the symposium a bit. But so you have a book coming out called Black Natural Law. First of all, what is Black Natural Law?
So in this book, I'm thinking about how a higher law or God's law has been invoked by black political leaders over the last couple of centuries, some of which we're very familiar with, like Martin Luther King in his letter from Birmingham Jail saying, you know, segregation is opposed to God's law. Right? Frederick Douglass does this, opposing slavery, opposing the Dred Scott decision. Anna Julia Cooper, the great black feminist leader, also W.E.B. Du Bois is often thought of as a very non-religious person, right? Has these appeals to natural law, higher law, sometimes God's law. So I'm tracking this tradition of appeals to higher law or God's law, and seeing it not as an invocation of, you know, you ought to live your life this way or you ought to live your life that way, but rather as a condemnation of worldly laws that go wrong, right? When the U.S. government or a state or even social norms say you ought to do this or you ought to do that, right? This appeal to something higher, to something beyond the world, beyond social norms, offered some critical leverage to challenge the ways of the world, right? To challenge what, you know, some in this tradition call idolatry, right? Just making of worldly laws, making them into gods, right? If you think that there's something higher than that, something beyond that, right, then you can challenge that, right? I don't think these thinkers are interested in the specific content of, you know, what God is thinking or what God's law might be, right? It's just a gesture towards something beyond what is here and now, right? Beyond what the world is saying.
Well, and so I think this maybe then makes for a nice transition into talking a bit about mass incarceration, because I suspect at least that this is part of the critique that you're bringing toward the many laws that have led to this inflation of incarceration, particularly of African Americans. Would you like to elaborate a bit on that connection?
Sure, yeah. So in this new project that I'm working on with a collaborator, Josh Dubler at the University of Rochester, we're thinking about how changes in the U.S. Religious landscape happen at the same time that there's this dramatic change in incarceration rates, and how might these be related? Our ultimate purpose is to create resources so that religious communities and, you know, criminal justice reform activists and organizers can work together, right? Can see that there's a common problem and have a common language to address it. So we're thinking about how, for example, there was once, you know, a robust discourse in mainstream U.S. politics of, you know, appealing to a higher justice, right? That our laws in the U.S. should try and resemble, right? So there might be laws that should be changed, and then they should be changed to get closer to this ideal of justice. And then at some point, there becomes a criminal justice system, right? Justice comes to mean just following the law properly, right? Just the law being implemented properly. There's no longer this sense that, you know, our laws are approximations of, you know, what this really good just order would look like, and we're still trying to get there. Rather, you know, the laws are what they are. You know, they need to be enforced. Right? And, you know, when there's no longer this sense of a higher ideal to which we can move, right? There's, you know, which might be referred to as godly or higher or whatever, you know, the enforcer of the law becomes the God, right? The police officer becomes, you know, comes into this role of a godlike figure who cannot be challenged, who is always correct, right? Who's, you know, all knowing, you know, all truthful, all good. And so, right, we're trying to think in this project about, you know, how might there be this sort of subtle entwining of, you know, religious ideas and political ideas that leads to this dramatic shift in how, you know, we think about law, justice, and, you know, that authorizes, right, this sort of rapid growth of the prison population.
It's interesting to me. So I can imagine academic audience being quite persuaded by this claim and it making sense. And I'm wondering if you've had a chance to, you know, test this out on actual religious communities and what they think, if so.
Yeah, so it's been fun working on this this project, and I think we're looking forward to over the coming couple of years as we're finishing up the book and, you know, speaking with people about it, that, you know, great aunt is, you know, the member of a social justice committee of her church in northern Wisconsin in Wausau. And so talking to people like this and to others, who are very much eager to do something about mass incarceration, because as you were saying, Karma, earlier, right, it's become something to name as the racial injustice of our era, right, in the same way that slavery and segregation once were. I think the challenge is to say, okay, we know that this is a problem now. What can we do about it? And I think there's a community of sort of leftist activists and organizers, you know, who've been talking about mass incarceration for a long time, sure, for decades, right, since the 19th century, right, you know, problems of incarceration and convict labor and so on. But a community of sort of leftist activists and organizers who've been thinking about what to do about it, right, who've been thinking about the radical alternatives to incarceration, thinking about how to challenge, right, the building of new jails and prisons, as, you know, activists in Madison have done, right? So there are answers to, you know, what can we do now, right, if we sort of create these bridges or a common language between, you know, the great aunts and their social justice committees of their church and, you know, my friends in Oakland who are wearing all black and, you know, eating their vegan food and going to Food Not Bombs, right? You know, how can these two groups, you know, talk to each other? And, you know, they have so much to share with each other. If only they could see that, you know, religion, one doesn't have to be allergic to religion, and one can learn a lot from religious communities, but one can also learn a lot from these activists who've been thinking about this for so long.
And so there's actually like some really right possibility for coalition building that hasn't been maybe fully tapped into. Vincent Lloyd, I wanted to give us a chance to maybe use the conversation about mass incarceration and prisons to tie into this conversation about debt and property that you're going to be having next weekend at the symposium. And maybe if you could say a bit about how you decided to frame the symposium in this way.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to this conversation on Friday and Saturday here in Madison, and to the conversation that you're facilitating on Saturday about these issues. What we noticed was that, you know, finally we're talking about debt, right? Because of the 2008 financial crisis, because of the foreclosure crisis that is acutely and particularly affecting communities of color, we're thinking about debt, but sometimes in a narrow financial sense, right? Of, you know, these mortgages that are underwater, or consumer credit, payday loans, right? At least this is becoming part of the conversation, which is important, right? Because these are, you know, sites at which, you know, injustices are occurring. But what if we think about debt in a larger sense, right? In a broader sense, and thinking about the many different sort of connotations and associations of debt and property, right? And if we do that, maybe we can see sort of lines of continuity going back longer in history, lines of continuity to slavery or to the sorts of redlining practices that prevented black home ownership, that dispossessed, you know, practices dispossessing indigenous peoples of land, right? There are all these interesting associations that if we use the foreclosure crisis as a starting point, we might see. But we also might see debt, you know, as a demand, a political demand, right? Is there a debt owed to those who have been dispossessed, right? Are there debts owed to black or indigenous communities? What kind of organizing can be facilitated by thinking about debt both as a negative thing, a problematic thing, but also as a constructive rhetoric?
Let's talk a bit about that particular piece, the kind of productive ways that we might reimagine is what I want to say, but the productive ways we might engage with the concept of debt. And of course, I'm thinking a bit about what was happening a few weeks ago when, you know, Bernie Sanders, sort of the most impractical politician of all, says, well, you know, reparations are too impractical; it would never pass Congress. In your view, you know, maybe what is Sanders tapping into, or what is he missing in that conversation that might be part of what you're trying to get at in this conversation?
Yeah, so I think in part this is maybe my interest in religion as something that can expand the imagination, right? That if it looks as if, you know, there are these different options on the table and these are the options that, you know, there's a clear path on how to achieve them, right? Then we might miss possibilities to reframe the conversation, right? And we're both, Karma and I are both rhetoricians or scholars of rhetoric, and I think rhetoric can be a very powerful way of, you know, opening up the imagination, right, and showing us that there might be options that we've never considered, right, that there might not be a clear path to achieving, but that might, you know, if we're open to them, might create new conversations and new sorts of practices that could, you know, create even more just outcomes than were previously imaginable. And I mean, I think reparations discussions, you know, at their best can do this. Jubilee debt forgiveness discussions, 15 years ago, I think were also, in terms of Global South debt forgiveness, were also a way of doing this in terms of thinking, you know, why are these nations in the Global South accumulating such a huge debt to the IMF, World Bank, and nations in the U.S. and Europe? Could this debt just go away? And of course, Jubilee is a biblical concept that was reappropriated and resignified in this sort of political context. I think conversations like this conversation we're going to have on Friday and Saturday about debt and property, are ways of expanding our sort of political vocabulary or repertoire of languages and practices that can, when expanded, you know, give us new ways of struggling for justice.
Mm-hmm. And you've put together you and your I'm forgetting your colleague's name. Who's your co-organizer?
Amaria Armstrong.
Yeah. Okay, mm-hmm. Just wanted to make sure to get her name mentioned on the air too. And so you've put together an impressive slate of speakers. I wonder if you could talk about just a couple of those who folks might maybe locally you think be most interested in coming to hear.
Sure. For example, among the speakers is Cheryl Harris, a professor of law at UCLA, who's written a very influential article called Whiteness as Property, which has received wide circulation over the years. And is Professor Harris is really a leader in the critical race studies movement in the legal academy. Devin Fergus is a professor at Ohio State University who's written about the way that the Black Power movement was sort of co-opted by these federal government programs to fund poor communities, and how the same sort of Black Power activists became the administrators in these right in these government-funded sort of like welfare and community benefit organizations. And his new project is on. His new book is called Land of the Fee, that he's working on, F-E-E-E, thinking about America not as a place characterized by freedom, but of, you know, all these sort of consumer fees and all sorts of other fees that we have to interact with in our lives that are particularly harshly affecting communities of color. Jody Melamed, who's at Marquette and has been active in sort of Wisconsin activism, and organizing, particularly in Milwaukee, has very interesting thoughts on neoliberalism and multiculturalism and how these can work together. So multiculturalism might seem like a nice thing where we all sit around in circles and share our stories about our cultures that we come from, but it also might be connected with these sorts of neoliberal projects of, you know, the state receding and private companies, you know, taking over state functions and individuals, particularly people of color, suffering. So those are three of the.
Yeah, I mean, and so this is meant to be open to the public. So some of this will be, it will be heady academic conversation in a certain sense. But I think each of the speakers has a strong commitment to their ideas being useful to ordinary folks. And so, if you're thinking about whether you should show up or not, I think the answer is definitely yes. You want to show up for this. And the community conversation on Saturday, I'm going to be hosting it kind of radio style with Cindy Ifen Chang, who's a Asian American American Studies and history professor at UW Madison, and of course M. Adams of Freedom Inc. And so that will be a fun conversation. We're going to be looking at the some segments from the Ferguson Report, the Justice Department's Ferguson Report that was put out, and kind of engaging these issues in a more dialogic way. So a lots to be gained there. Vincent Lloyd, I wanted to kind of end on a note with you to ask you about, you know, we here in Madison, we're about to embark on the 1 year anniversary of the police murder of Tony Robinson, the unarmed African-American youth who was killed last March 6th. And you know, no punishment for the police officer, Matt Kinney. And we continue here in Madison, Dane County, struggling with racial justice. And I'm wondering, based on a lot of the things we've been talking about today, the things you know, you also have family and personal connections here in Madison. We just have about a minute or two left, but are there any insight you have about what we might do as we're thinking about how to move into the next year following this anniversary?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I'm looking forward to being at the commemoration event over the 1 year anniversary of the death coming up in a couple of days. I think on the one hand, it sounds too easy and obvious to say, you know, building broad coalitions that tap, you know, partners who one might not expect to be invested in these issues is important, but. My work has been thinking about how religious communities, are in many cases a sort of untapped site of resources that are primed to be concerned about issues of justice. And if we have the patience and the languages to communicate with them, that's important to do. But I mean, I also think, you know, political formation, on the left is essential, not just showing up for protests or that's important. Building relationships and building power through organizing is important. But, struggling with each other over, ideas, right, on the left in our organizing is crucial. And, building those reading groups that don't just read the leftist blogs, but struggle through Marx's Capital and struggle through Lenin and so on. I mean, these are sort of essential to building our own capacities to be critical and to organize in the ways that are the most effective.
Well, that's a fantastic note to end this conversation. Vincent Lloyd, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Karma.
Again, our guest is Dr. Vincent Lloyd, who's an assistant professor of religion at Syracuse University and also currently a fellow here at the UW Institute for Research in the Humanities, hosting symposium next Friday and Saturday at the Fluno Center on UW's campus, Race, Property, and Debt, with some great speakers there, conversation on Saturday as well. So I hope folks will get out to that. And also, Vincent's here for the next few months, and so if you'd like to have a conversation with him, I'm sure he would be open to that as well. I'm Karma Chavez, and this is A Public Affair.
Above sea level, I grab the mic.